Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program that focuses on the jobs, the incomes, the debts, the future, and the present of our economic situation. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. A little later in the program, we're going to have an interesting interview, and I will explain how you can follow the kinds of work we do on this program through our websites and in a number of other ways. But I like in the beginning of the program to jump right in and talk a little bit about some of the major events of the last week and of the last month. A couple of days ago, Janet Yellen, the head of the Federal Reserve, gave one of those speeches that the world's press looks at in the hopes of understanding where the economy is going. And as usual, Janet Yellen, a woman who went to graduate school together with me many years ago at Yale University, left everybody wondering which way the wind was blowing, either because she would prefer us to be confused or she's confused herself. We'll never know. Here's what she said. In some ways, the economy seems to be improving. In other ways, the economy seems to be in trouble. And in still other ways, it seems to be declining. She indeed said all of those things. And therefore, we don't know exactly what we were going to do, and we don't know exactly when we're going to do it. So I don't have much to add to that kind of clarity, so I'll just leave it with that and let you know that when you read next time in the newspaper about an economic recovery, that one of the highest officials of our country could not find one to be relied upon to do anything in particular at any time in the future. The second item I want to talk about has to do with Germany, in particular with its financial center in Frankfurt. Over the last week, there were enormous demonstrations. We're talking tens of thousands of people gathered in that city. Who were they? They were a new movement called Blockupy. Where did they get the name from? From Occupy Wall Street back in 2011. This is the next incarnation, and it starts in Germany. It didn't start in the United States as the last one did. Blockupy is different in a number of other ways. It is an alliance of political organizations, but also it is an alliance that includes, for example, Verdi. That's the name of the largest trade union in Germany, which is now participating, not as an occasional partner, not as an onlooker, but as an integral part of what this movement is. It's also European. The reason it happened in Germany is not so much about Germany. It's about the fact that the European Central Bank, that's the equivalent in Europe of what the Federal Reserve is in this country, has its headquarters in Frankfurt, Germany. And so people gathered from all over Europe to demonstrate against the divisive role being played by the European Central Bank in the policies that are called in Europe austerity. And there were tens of thousands of people who gathered to protest the assault on working people across Europe by the austerity programs of the governments, all of which are coordinated and financed by the European Central Bank. And nothing could further clarify what's going on here than the story that appeared on the 19th of March in the New York Times, which quoted a young Danish woman who had come together with 100 other Danish citizens on a bus down to Frankfurt. That's a several-hour ride for people from Denmark. And here's what she told the New York Times. I will quote it. "I believe in fighting against the system. It won't change if you don't do something. I am here for solidarity." Well, for those who thought that Occupy Wall Street was dead and gone, it never was. It continues around the United States, for example, but it is surging in Germany. Third item for today, I want to give a support to the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio. He did something interesting, and not only for the citizens of New York, but for the country as a whole and indeed for the world. This last week, he signed a bill called Intro 423. This bill will track and assess the effectiveness of worker co-ops in the city of New York, of which there are many. Indeed, if you track on your own system, on your own computer, Intro 423, you will find your way to a long listing of the new and developing worker co-ops in New York City. This is very, very important because worker co-ops are a fundamental alternative to the capitalist, hierarchical, top-down enterprises that we are all used to, where a tiny group of people, major shareholders and boards of directors, make all the basic decisions, and the rest of us, the workers, have to live with the result of those decisions, but we are excluded from participating in making them. This used to be something called exploitation without representation. That is, it's an arrangement that is undemocratic. Worker co-ops are an answer to that. Now, for a long time, worker co-ops were ignored, marginalized, not taken seriously. That's why it's a milestone that in the largest city of the United States, the mayor of that city acknowledged in his speech last week when he signed the bill that worker co-ops are a very important new development in the city in terms of their importance and a major matter for the city to keep track of and for the city to support as an alternative economic organization, let's call it. My only quibble with the mayor, and I appreciate what he did here, my only quibble with the mayor is that he seemed to be saying that this was an institution particularly relevant to poor people, to get them out of unemployment, to get out of poverty, and so on. And indeed, that is a role that worker co-ops have often played in the history of the world. As some of you know from this program, I often talk about the largest and most successful worker co-op in the world today, which is called the Mondragon Corporation from Spain. That was started back in the 1950s for poor people by a Roman Catholic priest named Father Arizmendi, who began that movement, and it has built to the situation today where that's the seventh largest corporation in Spain and has 100,000 employees. Wow, that shows you where it can go. But as the Mondragon Corporation taught us, this is not something only for poor people. This is something for all working people who don't want to live and work inside an undemocratic organization of work and would prefer to work at a place where they're taken seriously for their mental capacity, for their ability to understand, design, and change an enterprise, and not simply be worker drones who come 9 to 5 to do what they are told. Next, I want to talk about a little college in Virginia. It's one of the few remaining women's colleges, all women's colleges, in the United States. It's called, has a lovely name, Sweetbriar. Sweetbriar College. What happened this last week was stunning. The board of directors of Sweetbriar College informed the world that they were closing Sweetbriar College, basically forever. Wow. Suddenly, without warning, a tiny group of people, effectively the board of directors of that college, ended it. It's been around for many, many decades. Jerry Falwell used to call it the Harlots on the Hill College because he didn't like its liberal orientation as a liberal arts college, which it what always was. So this is ending one of the few all-women's colleges left in the United States. It is seriously disrupting the lives of those students who either have their education interrupted or will now have to scramble to find another place, go to a new school, learn its new ways, live with new friends, etc. Terribly disruptive of these young people at a key moment in their development and the careers they're going to have. It's a terrible blow to Amherst County, Virginia, where the college is located, because it employs a significant number of people who then in turn maintain the local small businesses in that area. In short, a tiny group of people, the board of directors, a handful, have made a decision impacting thousands of other people for reasons which even the local Roanoke papers find mysterious. They still have over $85 million in an endowment. They occupy and own 2,300 acres of land in a very important part of this country. They have all kinds of assets. They have all kinds of traditions. They have a big alumni organization of all the women that have been there. They could have, and here comes my point, they should have handled this altogether differently. If something you do impacts hundreds of people, thousands of alumni, and many more thousands of local residents whose jobs and incomes and businesses depend, how can you in any vaguely democratic way impose on all of them such a shattering decision, having excluded them not only from participating in the decision, but from even knowing that it was being considered until it was a done deal, a fact? This is a wonderful example for me for why the kinds of ways we make decisions in the economic parts of our lives are so inappropriate, undemocratic, and literally screaming for change. To the credit of a number of the alumna of Sweetbriar, those women are not taking it sitting down. They are active, and they are trying to reopen this decision, trying after the decision was made to begin to get the inclusion of all the people that are affected that should have been making the decision but are now at least mobilizing to change it. That's a very healthy sign about the United States, and I just wanted to give a shout-out to the important effort being made in this little corner of the United States struggling with an issue that couldn't be more important for all of us. Okay, that's all the updates we have time for. I'm now switching to the second of the three kinds of things we do on this program. It's where I respond to questions that you have sent in. I want to remind everyone, very briefly, to use our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain a great deal of material that expands upon what we do here on the program. And both websites allow you, by clicking on an icon, to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and so on. And finally, both websites allow you to communicate to us, tell us your questions, what you like and don't like about the program. We read every single one. And what I'm about to do is to respond to some of those selected questions. Here's the first one. And this is something several of you have written to me about. Many Americans seem to feel that the United States is a Christian nation. Now, you might wonder, how is this a topic for a program called Economic Update? And the answer is, as your questions show you understand, that Christian nation for these folks seems to also mean that you love capitalism, that our economic system is somehow uniquely Christian, and that Christians should be pro-capitalist and people who like capitalism should be Christians, or something that makes these two together. And here's the questioner's blunt point. I don't feel that way. I, says this writer, I am a devout Christian, but I don't think capitalism embodies Christian values. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. I think the capitalist celebration of making money supports greed and exploitation, which for me are precisely the things that a Christian commitment puts you against, not for. Would you comment? Well, I could talk a long time, longer than you would want to listen to me, about this topic since it's so important in American history. But I'm not going to respond that way. I'm actually going to respond by giving you a mini book review, because a book has been published that I want to bring to your attention that explains a great deal about what this question talks about. The author is Kevin Cruz, K-R-U-S-E, Kevin M. Cruz. And he wrote a book published by Princeton University Press, and an interesting title, How Business Made Us Christian. And here's what he does. He shows that Americans who have been Christian a long time in large numbers have been very mixed and differentiated one from the other when it comes to capitalism. It is not true that this country was Christian in the sense of being pro-capitalist all its life, not at all. What he points out, and he does a stunning job of this, is that after World War II, many people in the business community, the big business community, He mentions Harvey Firestone of the tire company, Conrad Hilton of the hotel company, Fred Maytag, I don't have to tell you what company that is, Henry Luce of Time Magazine, leaders at U.S. Steel, General Motors, DuPont, and so on. We're terribly concerned that in the 1930s and 40s, the Roosevelt New Deal had emerged, whose idea was you should tax corporations and the rich to help the mass of people in the middle class and thereby create the middle class. And they were very concerned because they didn't like paying those taxes. They didn't like any of this. But they didn't know how to win people over. Remember, the mass of Americans clearly loved the idea of taxing corporations and the rich. You know how we know that? Because the one president who really did that, Franklin Roosevelt, was reelected four times overwhelmingly in this country. He was the most popular president the United States had ever had. No president ever came close to being reelected four times. It was so overwhelming that after he died, the Republicans pushed through in the Congress the law that limits presidents to two terms so they wouldn't have to face this again. That was Professor Cruz's point in his book. Business decided they had to make a mass base for pro-capitalism, pro-big business. And the way to do that was to make common cause with Christian fundamentalism. And he demonstrates the important role played by three ministers in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. James Fifield was one, and he takes us through the whole business like that. The second one was Abraham Varied, if I can pronounce his name correctly. And the third one is a name I think most of you know, Billy Graham. And he tracks through how the business community approached them, worked with them in order to develop the idea that being a Christian means celebrating and endorsing the economic system we have and excludes people like the person who wrote to me who says he is a Christian but does not find capitalism to be part of that faith for him. In the time we have left, I want to deal with a couple of other questions that you sent in. One that I found particularly intriguing has to do with Uber, the new service everywhere in the United States, or at least in large cities, that is competing with taxi companies. This is an arrangement in which you call a telephone number or you use an app on your telephone to summon a car and a driver who comes and fetches you, like a cab might have, like a taxi cab in the past did, and takes you wherever you're going. It's all paid for by your smartphone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the questions that are coming in typically ask me the following. Isn't this a good thing? Aren't there lots of people getting jobs, often using their own automobile to do this? Isn't this a marvelous new way to use technology that we couldn't do before? And aren't the taxi companies and the regulators and the taxi drivers just kind of old-fashioned fuddy-duddies holding back new technology? And therefore, shouldn't we all support Uber? By the way, Uber is clever in its advertising program. It refers to itself as part of the, I couldn't make this up, sharing economy. Okay, let's talk about this. We need some history just to make sure we're all on the ground here. In every industry I am aware of, where capitalist enterprises got involved to make money by producing food or producing clothing or producing you name it. Here's what happened sooner or later. In the competitive struggle of the capitalist enterprises, one with the other, where you make money if you succeed and you go out of business if you don't, where everything is about cutting corners so you can save on costs and maybe lower your price and that way beat your competitor, et cetera, et cetera. In every industry, sooner or later, and it's usually sooner, it was found that some of these capitalist competitors were taking risks with our lives in order to make money. They were producing food that was contaminated, that was unhealthy. And it went so far that great writers in American history, Upton Sinclair, Sinclair Lewis, and a whole host of others, had to write stunning exposés. By the way, people have been doing that ever since, because this problem never goes away. And so we developed, guess what? A government regulation agency, the Food and Drug Administration, to be particular, to regulate and control, because capitalists left to themselves will put profits ahead of what they ought to be doing, which is serving us as the customers. So we've had regulation because of capitalism. The taxi industry is no different. As the taxi industry developed, capitalists became involved. They hired teams of drivers. Guess what happened? They weren't as careful over time as they should have been about training the drivers. They weren't as careful as they should have been about maintaining the cabs. They weren't as careful as they should have been about providing insurance so that if you have an accident, you can recover as an innocent passenger in a taxi. So guess what happened? We regulated taxis. Here in New York, for example, we have a taxi and limousine commission that supervises and makes sure that we're safe, because to rely on private enterprise to do that doesn't work. That's what our history shows. So what is Uber doing? Well, Uber is doing what always happens. After a while, when the regulators kind of work it out, we're going to make you have a good insurance, say in the cab industry. We're going to make sure you have a insurance. We're going to make sure you maintain the quality of the engine and the other running parts of the taxi. We're going to make sure you have a proper license. We're going to make sure you're a reliable person. All of the important things anyone sitting in a taxi wants to know, the regulators made sure. And they said that includes paying a decent living wage to a taxi driver so that he or she isn't forced to do things that could end up making it difficult for a passenger because the worker is too tired, because he or she has to have three jobs to get by, et cetera, et cetera. So regulation ends up giving workers a decent wage, giving the companies a rate of profit they can live with, and making this system do what it was set up to do. It's then only a matter of time until an enterprising new capitalist comes in and says, wait a minute, maybe I can figure out a way not to pay workers what the taxi drivers are getting, not to cover myself with insurance the way they have to, not to be careful about who I hire the way they have to, and therefore I can do it a little more cheaply, and I can get customers to leave the regulated industry and come to the unregulated ones. And often they succeed. And that's what Uber is, an attempt to break down the old arrangement and start what? Start it all over again. Because if Uber does it, so will the others. There's half a dozen companies doing what Uber now does, providing the same kind of independent driver riding system. And guess what? They're already having problems with unqualified drivers, insufficiently insured vehicles, inadequately maintained vehicle. They're rewriting the history again. And you know what's going to happen? It's already happening in certain cities in America and in other countries. Uber is being besieged by people who say we need, you guessed it, government regulation to prevent them from doing exactly what the car taxi companies in the beginning also did. So don't be fooled. This isn't about new technology. If that's what we wanted to deal with, if we really have a new technology that's better, then a reasonable way to handle it would be for the new technology to be integrated into the existing taxi business. Let's figure out how to do that. That takes into account that we want and need safe rides, that we want to pay people a reasonable wage and salary for the work they do, and that we want it all to be a safe, regulated business. We didn't do that. We don't even know how to do that in this society. So what we do is we wait until the only way the new technology can be brought in is by a ridiculous re-beginning of a history whose end we already know. Meanwhile, large numbers of people are subjected to unsafe rides, and the salary level of people in the industry is depressed. Taxi drivers are terrified about their own future. What a mess. And to say that capitalism is a paragon of efficiency, given what I've just told you, is too funny for words. Okay. Here's the last one. People are asking me, which is an interesting phenomena itself, in your emails to us, is the American economic system in such trouble that we're on the verge of, or that we could see in the near future, really basic economic changes where our whole system of capitalism is called into question? Well, I think the answer to this question is, I don't know, and that's the only honest answer I think is available out there. But here's what I can offer to the questions that have come in. To make fundamental change, you always really need two things. You need a set of conditions that have become intolerable to a large number of people. And number two, and it's not the same thing, a large number of people have to be aware of that. They have to see that the problem is the economic system. The system in trouble by itself isn't going to change because people don't have the idea that that's a solution. And if people think that that's a solution, but the system isn't intolerable for enough people, you're not going to have change either, because the people who think about it and want it are going to find it too hard to find followers, to find people to make it happen. So basically, my answer is this. The United States, in order to be on the verge of big change, would have to have an economy that's intolerable for huge numbers of people and the consciousness that that's the issue. Some people used to call that the objective conditions for social change and the subjective condition, the conditions in our minds. I would agree that the economy that we have now is not working for the majority of Americans, and that that's a very profound reality. Whether the consciousness is there, I think that's a bigger, an open question, and we'll come back to it in programs in the future. Folks, we've come to the end of the first half of this program. I want to thank you for being with us, and I want to ask you, please, to stay with us for a short break when we will come back, and I will introduce Bob Henley, my guest for today, and we'll have our interview. This is Economic Update. Your host, Richard Wolff, will be right back. Welcome back. This is the second half of Economic Update for this week. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and I'm very pleased and proud to have with me today someone whom I'll introduce to you in just a moment, but I want to tell you about him beforehand. I want to tell you that he is an expert by virtue of what he has been doing most of his adult life on what goes on in the governments, particularly of New Jersey and New York, but with emphasis on New Jersey. He has studied it top to bottom. He's been a reporter. He's someone who can tell us about how government is and is not working, and that's why I brought him. I want to focus on the economic dimensions of government. That's what this program focuses on. But I think he's a unique resource, so I'm terribly proud to introduce to you Bob, or Robert, if you like, Henley.
Bob's fine.
Is Bob all right?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. Bob Henley is an award-winning investigative reporter. He's a frequent contributor to Salon, which you can find on the internet, of course. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, The Guardian over in Great Britain, The Village Voice, and dozens of others. His broadcast journalism credits include CBS's 60 Minutes, PBS's NewsHour, NPR, WNYC, the Canadian Broadcasting System, the British Broadcasting Company. It's extraordinary where he has been and who he has taught all about how government works. He's currently a political analyst for WBGO, an NPR station in Newark, New Jersey. Over the years, he has written on international and national affairs. He's covered everything from offshore tax havens to the cascading political scandals that have roiled his native New Jersey for the last 30 years. Wow, Bob,
well,
that's great.
It's an honor to be here, Richard. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, let's start off with the big perspective. What is your sense from all your reading and all your work? How do Americans these days view their government in terms of its relationship to them as citizens and particularly to their economic well-being?
What's instructive is, and dovetails with the first portion of the program, is just as the economy is not working, a new Gallup poll shows that a majority of Americans think their primary problem is their government. There's this pervasive sense that, and this came out in polling exit data nationally in the off-year elections in 2014, that the government is working for the top 1% overtime and leaving the bulk of humanity out of their calculations.
Do they have, is it fair to even ask this question, do they have a sense of why that is? What do the American people have in their minds, from what you can tell, that would account for that? How do they explain to themselves why this is?
When you go up and encounter people when they finish voting, and more importantly, when you go out and do enterprise reporting on election day, which I like to do when people aren't voting, because that's an important thing here, we have a shrinking participation in America of politics in terms of the traditional going out and voting. And then when you ask people why they're alienated from it, they believe that there's so much money involved in politics. You have this perverse relationship with the more money that's coming in, and we're seeing unprecedented amounts after right. Citizens United, the fewer people turn out. And this creates a kind of race to the bottom where they're spending billions of dollars to turn out people that are a smaller and smaller base that are more ideologically fringe, if you will. And so you have a Republican Party increasingly held hostage by a shrinking group of people that are well-mobilized that they know will turn out.
And so, and then, would it be fair to conclude from what you said that there's a kind of vicious cycle, what you call maybe the race to the bottom here, in which more and more money controls the politics, that alienates more and more people who withdraw, that brings in the money in an irony, because now the money understands it's a fewer and fewer people they have to focus on to control the outcome for everybody, and it becomes more manageable for the money, who then do it more, who then alienate more, and we're just kind of spiraling into a politics that is irrelevant for most people.
Right, right. Only you could really boil it down like that. In fact, it's a technique that they talk about in their closed-door sessions of voter suppression. It's not just a coincidence, a happy coincidence. It's actually something that's a goal. When you have a candidate that's surging, what they'll do is draw out the negatives about this person, which requires a huge amount of Baltimore broadcast ads, and then not so much turn the mind of the voter to support another candidate, but demobilize them and disempower them, alienate them, and have them stay home. That's America in the 21st
century. is, so I want to understand. So they get interested in a candidate, and then they're hit with a barrage of negative stuff about them.
To destroy that the image of that person. That's where we are.
And so they kind of have second thoughts and say it's all disgusting. I won't have to do with it.
Voter suppression 101.
Okay. And you see that more and more?
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing, too, it's important to know is that within the campaign structure, campaign managers and consultants are paid a kickback of the percentage of the ads they place in broadcast outlets. It's a whole hidden economy where they are getting, the more they go to broadcast and the more money they spend, the actual more money goes to these consultants. It's similar to the hidden economy. You may have covered this, the business of slotting in supermarkets, where
you're positioned on the shelf.
Right. And this is, you know, every so often there'll be a dramatic hearing where individuals will be, their identity will be disguised because they're former distributors for Frito-Lay or Coca-Cola. And they'll talk about that this hidden economy, this so-called free market, is really about giving money to middle management, upper management, to even buy spaces in the warehouse so that the choices you're getting are limited when you think you're in the cathedral of American capitalism, the supermarket.
Okay. I want to turn now, and I understand that this is a little dicey, but I want to do it. I want to turn now to your state, where you have been a citizen for many, many years.
Yes, born.
Where you've been a reporter, where you've studied it, where you've been writing recently really wonderful pieces. My audience may not know this, but if you check Bob Hennelly, you'll find remarkable investigative reporting of the sort that we have way too little of in this country. But before I ask you about your native state and what's going on there, I want people to understand that we're going to focus on New Jersey, your state,
right.
Not because New Jersey is better, worse, unique, or anything like that. In the opposite, that New Jersey is a state in the United States, and what we're about to investigate regarding New Jersey isn't all that different from what we will find if we investigated any other state
right.
in this country. But with that caveat, let's begin. I want to ask you to tell us a story, take even a few minutes to do it, of the relationship between the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, a person my audience knows because of his efforts to be a Republican presidential candidate, and one or another of the multiple scandals that have involved the kind of illustration of the reason why Americans are as skeptical as you've said. And you can either choose the pension crisis of public employees or the Exxon oil disaster or the closing of the bridges to New York City. I mean, unfortunately, the choice is infamous.
We'll take A and B. We'll do a compression.
You choose. You know the best.
Well, what's fascinating here is that Chris Christie is in ascendancy as a national figure because he's a fabulous entertainer. And I will tell you off the top, I was detailed as a pool reporter and rode a Black Hawk helicopter for the first time into the Sandy damaged areas, where I saw him do an amazing, almost shaman job of being present with people who had lost everything. I must say that, yeah. Because if we just have an ad hominem attack, your listeners will know that it's just propaganda. That said, Governor Christie is going around the country saying that he has had this success as a bipartisan figure in New Jersey. That's what his shtick is. He's a governor, Republican, elected twice in a blue state. One of the things that he rose to prominence on was the fact that historically the public pensions the benefits were increased and the state did not stay current on its payments to keep those anchored to reality. Right. This was done by both Republicans and Democrats and create a situation where there was a multi-billion dollar gap, one of the largest in the country. I think Illinois might be larger, but a huge heavy lift. He did have a moment in 2011 where he engaged the Democrats, Senate President Steve Sweeney, an iron worker, who was president at the time of the Iron Workers Union, and Assembly Speaker Sheila Oliver at the time. And they did come up with a grand bargain to save the public pensions and bring down the long-term liability. Public workers agreed to pushing out the retirement age in light of what's happening with the actuarial tables. They agreed to pay more into the public pension system. And the one requirement on the governor's side was that he make $2.4 billion in payments over 18 months to break with his predecessors of both parties and keep good faith with the public workers. He decided, when he made an 8% projection for revenue increases that fell short, to not make that commitment. At that point, from my standpoint, he disqualified himself permanently from the presidency. Had he redeemed that promise by a mix of cost-cutting and raising taxes, he could definitely stand on the national stage and make some representation that he had created a bipartisan resolution that could have been some kind of platform for the serious issues we face going ahead with entitlements. Quickly, on the Exxon front, in the
Let me turn you down, because I know you're trying to get all of this in. The bottom line then, just to make sure I understand you and my listeners do, he promises to make good the public pensions that have been part of the pay packages of public employees in the state for decades.
Right.
He recognizes, as do the workers, that it's an economic crunch, even though they don't cause that crunch. So they make concessions. They postpone their retirement. They put more money into the retirement program. And his job is to make sure that the state puts in the money that they're committed by law to pay out to these workers when they retire. And then he goes back on that arrangement in order to what? Not tax people in New Jersey, to look like he's a governor who doesn't raise taxes, by basically shafting one group of citizens in the hope of pandering to the rest of the citizens.
And I might say, personally for him, also torpedoing, I believe, any real shot at the presidency. I mean, I think he's self-destructed in that regard. The problem is that we have a national media that so badly wants access to him. I'm talking about Morning Joe and the rest, that they don't ever dig in to exactly what's happening on the ground, but continue to be engaged by his considerable charisma and his showmanship.
Okay. Let's turn, though, to a man who, if he shot himself in the foot around pensions, now with the disaster of the pollution of a huge part of the New Jersey-New York waterways, which we call here the Exxon scandal, named after, well, I don't have to say, do I? Tell us a little bit about that and what you think that shows about government these days.
Well, one of the things that's important to understand is that, as you mentioned before about regulation and how important that is, for three administrations prior to Governor Christie, career public servants working in the Attorney General's office, along with outside counsel, were pursuing claims against ExxonMobil, which has operated in Bayonne and in that Elizabeth area along the it's like we call it the Newark Bay, if you will. But actually, geographically, it includes portions of Staten Island and New York. So it's a bioregional resource. For years, since going back over 100 years, Standard Oil, which is the predecessor, of course, of ExxonMobil, went in and basically created a refinery operation. They processed just billions and billions of gallons of oil. In the process, made themselves hugely rich in terms of their shareholders. And much of what they were doing even predated our understanding of the impact on the environment. And from time to time, there were major explosions, major leaks, and what had been one of the richest estuaries in the world. I mean, at one time in this region, in the 1880s, 1890s, people were eating oysters out of this area, which was a major safety net for people in terms of subsistence. Even up through the Depression, as Robert Kennedy Jr. reminded me, this was an opportunity for people to go down and get some protein out of the natural systems. That was destroyed by what Exxon and others did over a period of time. There's a concept in law called natural resources damages. This is from the concept that goes back to the Justinian Code and to the Magna Carta, that riparian lands and the saltwater marshes, the coastline, the wildlife belong to the people and are held in trust by the state. So when you despoil them and degrade them as a private concern, you have to compensate under this theory of law the public for the loss of it and the degradation and make it whole. Yeah. Not just on the little spot that you were using, but on the broader impact to the natural resource base. Yeah. Governor Christie, there was supposed to be $8.9 billion natural resource damage assessment, certainly, and he settled it for $225 million.
Let me slow you down. The $8.9 billion, this was what? Who produced that number, and what was its standing?
We'll take it inside that litigation. Back over 10 years ago, the state started the action. In order to do this, I had to prove, one, that Exxon had the liability, was responsible for it, and then there's a damage phase. In 2008, the state had a slam dunk, did very well in those preliminaries, and actually made Exxon liable in a court of law. Then just on the verge of Exxon, just in the last couple of weeks, just as the judge is ready to rule on what experts consider at least it was going to be $2.9 billion, maybe even higher.
That the judge would have imposed on Exxon.
Right. At that point, then Governor Christie's administration jumped out of the line of things and whispered in the judge's ear, we have a settlement. And in fact, it was $225 million, and they threw in 19 other gas stations. It's less than 3 cents on the dollar, the actual natural resources damages that were done. And the reason why this is so tragic is that this comes at a time where the public in New York and New Jersey has invested billions of dollars in sewer plants, which has improved the waterway. And so we could see a resurgence of the fishery, except for the fact that we're not dealing with these hotspots that Exxon's responsible for. Add to that that by restoring the freshwater wetlands and the saltwater marshes, we would be able to insulate ourselves better from storm events and the rising ocean that we know we're seeing. And we could do it on Exxon's dime at a time when we know the austerity out of Washington is in such a position, they're not going to be giving us the money that we need to create the resiliency that's required.
So from Exxon's point of view, obviously you're not part of Exxon's management, but help us. From Exxon's point of view, if I understand you, they were looking at a good chance of being out $2 to $3 billion
right,
until the governor came in and told them that they could get out of this disaster
right,
for a tiny fraction of that.
And what's critical to understand is that before that, the governor, who was chairman of the Republican Governors Association and very successful electing governors, received $750,000 from Exxon to the Republican Governors Association. I think that at least a grand jury should be convened, but there's crickets on that front.
Wow. So tell me a little bit. Help us. Help us to understand. Are we so far gone now that this is what's routine? Is it fair to say that an aspiring politician, Republican, Democrat, Christie, New Jersey, not New Jersey, not Christie, that this is now business as usual? That the way you move up the political system to its highest levels is by cutting these deals, and that the rest of us have to watch a kind of coming together of big business and the top levels of our political system to figure out endless ways to aggrandize themselves at our expense? Is that what we have?
Well, and I think that actually out of doing this story, one of the things that I've seen that's positive is that, first of all, there's a 30-day comment period that New Jersey has to have. And I would urge listeners to seek this out. The New Jersey DEP has to take public comment on this deal, and they have to report back to the judge, and that report has to incorporate the comments from the public. So this is really a global circumstance, because if New Jersey and New York get 3 cents on the dollar for damage awards, can you imagine what the going rate will be in Ecuador? What I am seeing is politicians stepping forward and coming up with creative solutions where New York politicians, who are normally weren't even included in this deal, are saying, wait a minute, we need to have some skin in this game, because this is an ecological resource, Newark Bay, that New York City shares in. So they're beginning to fight this battle bioregionally. I think there's an opportunity, if we focus locally and bring the passion that we have in national politics to local issues, we can leverage some change.
All right. That was going to be my segue into the final question, which is in many ways the million-dollar question, or these days, I should say, billion-dollar
right,
question.
Right. What
do we do about this situation? I mean, you're saying if the people listening to this program, if all the people that are no doubt outraged by this, because it's in the newspapers every day,
right.
There's no secret about
right.
this, we're hoping that they get galvanized. We're hoping that they pay attention. We're hoping that they make their voices felt. But people being under pressure in a bad economic
right.
situation have 1,000 other things on their minds. We don't seem to have any systemic way to prevent this from happening. We're creating a system in which there's every inducement for politicians and for corporations
True.
To play the game. And we counting on people who are exhausted and tired and underpaid and overworked to find the energy somehow to protest at least the worst examples. That doesn't sound like a good story going forward.
Well, there are examples, and net neutrality comes to mind. The
good.
Level of FCC response turned it around. it forced a president who's often distracted to do something and step forward and show more leadership in that regard, out-of-the-box thinking. It was a game changer, and that was driven by the public. Increasingly, we're seeing that leaders follow the public, and if you have used social media and focus again on granular things that you can identify the progress, and that's the problem, is that big items that are international in scope, it's hard to track progress, and we need to feel positive. So you have to dig in, and one of the things that I'm working right now is going around the entirety of Newark Bay, connecting communities that were separated by the state line, separated sometimes even by language, to feel vested in that estuary.
Tell me, do they like you?
Well, it's early in the process, but one of the things is if you look at so much of this environmental battles have to do with the fact that, unfortunately, environmentalism has primarily been driven by, if you look at it, you don't see the Sierra Club really getting traction in communities of color. This is the work that needs to be done. There is I'll give you an example. The Hudson River in New York and New Jersey is revered as an estuary, has all these organizations that have cropped up around it. But Newark Bay, which is surrounded by immigrants and communities of color, working class, poor people, there's not even the sense that this is an estuary that they're entitled to, that this is their commonwealth. Right. So we need to do that basic work so that they feel vested in its destiny.
It's really interesting, you know, as I have a series of interviews like with you, how often they end up with this story, that this is a system which could work if there were the kinds of involvement of masses of people whose interest is to make it work for them, and if they were willing to make the changes that have to be made so that it works for them. It seems to be the conclusion that keeps coming up as we go through one after another of the problems of our economic system, which is what the program is about. Would you have anything to say to an audience that finds what you say persuasive, that feels the way you do? What should they do?
I think that one of the things I've seen in my lifetime at 59 is the consciousness that people are bringing to their local community in terms of two issues, water and food production. And I lived this in my own life with my daughter's organic farm that she started on my property and now has just taken off. And also with people being organized around and conscious of the place where their water is coming from. If you don't have – you're too busy to do anything else, being invested in those things and looking for institutions that you either start or are part of that witness on behalf of that process, you begin to change things. I have seen in my lifetime the consciousness of watershed management come from the people. I've seen declines in all the kinds of volunteer groups. The kind of things de Tocqueville praised so much about America were in remission, except for this question of watershed associations. Throughout this country, this has caught the American imagination.
It's interesting because 6 months ago, the same thing was said to me about Detroit, that in Detroit, when the deterioration that's 40 years old in that city finally got to the point where people were being told they couldn't have any water anymore,
right,
suddenly it was that moment, that eureka moment, and people said, "Way, this has gone way too far." When we're talking in one of the richest countries on earth, that we can't provide water for people to drink, it's too much. And it was a galvanizing moment and helped develop the kind of pushing back to make Detroit come alive again that we now begin to see. All right, sir, thank you very much, Bob.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate your coming. Folks, as we come to the close, let me remind you, as I always do, we maintain two websites that expand on this kind of material, give you more material. They are available 24/7. They are absolutely free of charge. They're services that you can make use of. Please do. rdwolf with two Fs .com, rdwolf.com, and democracyatwork.info. They provide ways for you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, which we urge you to do, and we urge you to make use of the social media to share whatever you learn on this program with friends and enemies, too, if you can. We also tell you that these websites are ways that you can communicate with us and tell us your questions that we respond to, and so on. I also want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day that I use, that carries my written work, and that I urge you to take a look at as a resource like our websites that can serve you in a countless number of ways. I've also been asked to announce, because I haven't done this before, a talk that I give every month in New York City. For those of you in this area, in the New York area, but also for those of you that may have occasion to visit New York. Every month at 7:30 on the second Wednesday of the month, I give a talk in the Judson Memorial Church. It's a very historic church on Washington Square, which is itself a historic part of New York City. It's the only church on that square, so it's easy to find, Washington Square, Judson Memorial Church. Second Wednesday of every month, I give a talk called Monthly Economic Update, where I do what I do on this radio program, but in more detail on bigger subjects that really are crucial to what's happening in our economy. You are invited. Anyone you know who might be interested, come down to the church second Wednesday of every month, 7:30 in the evening. It's a chance for you not only to hear the kinds of analysis I do with more time to develop them, but also we often have questions and answers and a chance for you to engage with other people who share your interest. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Thank you so much for being with us, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
For the home of the road, baby, thing gonna change, baby. Your time now, baby, but after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.